update on? Technology, now I don't always get along really well. All right, we're going to transition just a little bit. Same prophet, different status. Have you ever seen an accident about to happen and felt helpless watching it unfold before your eyes? Some of you are nodding like it's actually happened. Recently, my daughter had something happen. Actually, I almost did too. It didn't actually end up happening, but a car spun out, and it's like, is he going to come over in my lane or not? Because he was totally out of control. Fortunately, the Lord settled him down right in his own lane, and there wasn't anyone else around him, so it ended up okay. However, my daughter saw one where she said it was the slowest accident. She said, I kept sitting there thinking, he's going to see him. And it wasn't snow related. It was just vision problems, I guess, or something. I don't know. So, yeah, it's frustrating when you see something like that happen. And imagine seeing a train wreck of a nation happening and realize that it's coming and feel so powerless, even though you're preaching the truth that they need to hear, and not able to do anything with it. Would have been such a difficult thing. I'm going to follow that up with a second question. Have you ever seen anything or had anything that was really beautiful destroyed? Okay, valuable, beautiful, important that was destroyed. How'd it make you feel? Or how do you think it would make you feel if it's never really happened to you before?
Devastation.
Absolutely devastated. Absolutely grief. Something that was so special, so important, and it's gone, destroyed. It is a grievous thing. When we talk about Lamentations, we're talking about the key concept or the theme is mourning. This is a prophet and a people who are in a state of mourning. And I really like the concept of a funeral for a city. That's really what this book is. It's the preaching of a funeral for a city that has met its demise. So we have gone up to, we've gone through all the kings. We've gone through the promises of soon destruction. We've hit the destruction with several different events, different times of Nebuchadnezzar coming into the country, into the city, deporting kings. This is actually going to come in kind of important when we cover Ezekiel in just a moment. But there's been several different times that he's been there, and the final destruction has taken place. And so we are at where on your timeline? We can pinpoint this pretty close. 586. That is the destruction of Jerusalem right there. Okay, so we are just after that point when Jeremiah, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, pens the mourning or the funeral dirge for the city of Jerusalem. So, as it says, the primary theme of the book is a lament or mourning over the woes that had fallen on sinful Judah. Do you think it might have been tempting to have said, I told you so? You knew this was coming. You got what you deserved. In our flesh, sometimes we are too quick at times to do something like that. Instead, Jeremiah felt the loss of the city very keenly, very acutely. And it was not a pleasant situation, nor is this book a pleasant situation. And yet, even in the midst of mourning, there can be hope, there can be confidence, a certain level of confidence. And I think that we'll see some of that as we go. To get a sense of it a little bit, of the situation, turn over to 1 Kings chapter 10. I don't know if you've ever done any study on the temples. David laid the groundwork in terms of collecting all the funds for the temple. Solomon had the privilege of putting it all together. And in his wisdom, having all the wisdom that God granted to him, do you suppose he built a little shack? The temple was amazing. And let's hear it from the words of a queen. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 1. When the queen of Sheba heard about the famous Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with difficult questions. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. And Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king, which he did not explain to her. Perhaps even some things about the temple itself, the city. And Solomon, and when the queen of Sheba perceived the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of the waiters and their attire, his cupbearers and a stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, what was her response?
Speechless.
Speechless. She was amazed. That is what happened to the city. The destruction of something that was not only beautiful, but it was precious. It was something that the Jewish people saw as indestructible and very, very precious. I am sure that their walls came crashing down, not just literally, but figuratively as well. That must have been such a difficult thing. And so Jeremiah pens Lamentations. At this point, the Lord was like an enemy. He had swallowed up Israel in all her places. The theme for, as it says, is the theme of mourning. So that should be a pretty easy one for you to remember for those future pop quizzes that you have. The focus of Lamentations is on God's judgment in response to the sin of the people. And the second theme which surfaces is the hope that's found in God's compassion. And so it goes on down to talk about the outline. There's the ruin, the wrath, the request for mercy, the review, and the request for restoration. Those are all part of his the sermons or his funeral sermons that he's preaching to the city and to the people. And in the midst of that, the key verse or verses, as is mentioned, Lamentations 2:3-22. Though the Lord's mercies, through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. That is a wonderful message of hope in the midst of ruination and destruction. And we need to hold on to and remember that even though God promises judgment, as he has for us in New Testament times as well, that there's still hope. There's still messages of hope and encouragement in the middle of that as well. Turn over to Psalm chapter 30, if you would, please. Somebody read verse 5. Do we have a need sometimes to console ourselves or to console someone else? The book of Lamentations is a book of mourning, but it's also a book of consolation. And so if the people had remembered or knew Psalm 30, verse 5, they would have known that even in his anger, even in his wrath, there is joy that comes in the morning. And that's part of what the key verse in Lamentations chapter 3, verse 22, the Lord's compassions are new and fresh every morning. So that's a great promise to us even when we're living in a culture that seems to be hard-hearted, people that won't listen to us. Sometimes we can see that train wreck happening, can we not? With family and friends and situations, we can see that happening. So does that mean that we just despair, that we preach a message of no hope? No. Obviously, there is mercies that are new and fresh, and much that we can appreciate from that. So as we think about connections to Christ and the gospel, Lamentations includes two elements that portray the Savior. It portrays him as a man of sorrows. We were talking about that a little bit earlier, particularly as Jeremiah's weeping over the destruction of Jerusalem is also perhaps a picture of Christ who wept over Jerusalem as well. So emotions are God-given, especially for some of us of the male gender. It's kind of a seen as a sign of weakness. I can think of nobody any stronger in the faith and in their resolve to do what God asked them to do than Jeremiah. And yet he wept. He mourned. And he wrote this. One of the things that from a key truth for Christian leaders, it mentions some things on your list. Recognizing that God is just, he does what he says, and yet his mercies are new every morning. And we can rest in that hope and in that confidence. I would also like to encourage you to think that even in the midst of despair and destruction, there are opportunities. One of the things that I have found over the years is that when there is grief, particularly in the time of death and a funeral, sometimes it's some of the most precious opportunities for the gospel and for the message of truth. People are, even though sometimes they're kind of stunned, they're still often very open in a way that they haven't been before. You see that what happened on 9/11 to our country. Did we say, whew, dodged that bullet or wasn't as bad as it could have been? It sobered us, didn't it? And God used it in a very positive way and in a lot of people's lives at that time. So from a leadership perspective, when we are dealing with people who are going through trials, should we weep and grieve with those who weep and grieve? Absolutely. And yet at the same time, do we grieve as people who have no hope? New Testament scriptures are very clear that in the hope of Christ, we always have hope to share. And so as you read and as you study the book of Lamentations, remember that part of the challenge is to recognize that even in the midst of tragedy, there are things that we can learn, that we can grow from as well. All right, let's go ahead. Time is slipping away very quickly. Let's go ahead. Any questions or thoughts about Lamentations before we go on? Quickly, as we get into Ezekiel, again, going back to the timeline, Ezekiel is a contemporary of Jeremiah. And so for a while, he was actually in Jerusalem at the same time that Jeremiah would have been there as well. But Ezekiel was taken captive. As I looked at it and studied it, it looks to me like that he was taken captive, from what I could tell, on the second time that Nebuchadnezzar comes into the city, which would have been around 598 BC. And he took upwards of 1,000 people, and that included Ezekiel. Who did he take the first time? Who went in the first? Okay, there was a king, and then we know that Daniel and his three friends went at that time. So they went, I think it was about 7 years earlier that they went, around 605 BC, and then in 598 BC, he came back, and during that time, took 10,000 to Babylon, and that included Ezekiel. And so Ezekiel wasn't nearly so much. He left before the final destruction. So that paints a little different picture, does it not? He was looking at that destruction from a distance. He was talking and and speaking to people who didn't believe in, even though they had been taken captive in Babylon, they didn't believe that Jerusalem would fall. So he had his problems and his challenges that he faced as well in preaching and proclaiming to the people that there was destruction coming as well. But he had the advantage, first of all, of not being at ground zero. And so his situation was different than Jeremiah's, in at least in that perspective. Is that a question? Yes. Captivity was in a sequence. Destruction would have been to a certain extent, but the final destruction of the temple happened in, what was it, 586? 586 BC. So that was when it was officially over. But it did happen in increments, incrementally. So you would think even that would get the people's attention, don't you think? The king's and the people's attention. Wow, we've got a king that is giving us fits. We don't have much defense, but their thought continued to be that God was going to protect Jerusalem because of who he had made Jerusalem to be. So the theme of Ezekiel is condemnation, followed by consolation, followed by restoration. So one of the key themes or thoughts is the glory of the Lord, which is it's a very uplifting message, or a very uplifting thought. But why would he be preaching, do you think, the glory of the Lord? As it says down in the middle paragraph, chief among the theological themes are holiness and sovereignty. These are conveyed by frequent contrasts of his bright glory against the despicable backdrop of Judah's sin. One of the things that we cannot get away from is just how far Jerusalem had fallen and the Jewish people, the Israelite people, and how hard-hearted they had become. And so as we think about the glory of the Lord, that would be such a strong contrast to the sin of the people and the conditions of the country itself, especially from a spiritual perspective. And as it says, the outline is basically broken up into two different pieces or places, the wrath of God against the nation and then followed by restoration. Ezekiel is a very unique book in that I'll read an explanation given by one of the books that I was reading. This exacting framework houses an unsurpassed depth of mystery and richness of vibrant imagery, symbolism, parables, allegories, and apocalyptic visions. Nine signs are found, six visions, six parables in them. And again, much like Jeremiah, he used object lessons, and but unlike Jeremiah, he was able to devote more, like Isaiah, devote more to the restoration and the future blessings of God's people as well. Connections to Christ. Christ the Messiah is pictured as a tender sprig that will be planted on a high and lofty mountain, a picture similar to that of the branch in Isaiah and Jeremiah, Zechariah. Ezekiel also speaks of Messiah as the king who has a right to rule and who will minister as a true shepherd. And key truths for Christian leaders, a good watchman warns. And that comes, and let's go to Ezekiel 3, beginning with verse 17. Someone want to read let's read verse 17 through 21. Let's just take a few. Dan, why don't we start with you and just go along the back over there, read from verse 17 through 21, please.
Verse 17
Ezekiel 3:17.
Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore, hear a word from my mouth, and give them warning from me.
When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou shalt givest him not warning, thou speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood, but his blood I require at thine hand.
But if you do warn the wicked man, he does not turn from his wickedness or from his evil ways, he will die from his sin, but you will have saved yourself.
When a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and a stumbling block for him, he shall die because thou hast not given him the warning. He shall die in his sin. His righteousness, which he hath done, shall not be remembered, but his blood I will require by him.
Nevertheless, if you warn the righteous man that the righteous should not sin, and he does not sin, he shall surely live because he took warning. Also, you will have liberty of this.
Unlike the false prophets, God's true prophets took those thoughts very seriously. And as leaders, we need to recognize that we have a responsibility to warn. One of the things that Pastor John has been talking about in Sunday school has been the concept of counsel, which can also be translated what? What are some other words that can be translated for counsel, giving counsel? Admonish?
Guidance.
And one of the words is warning. So sometimes some of our counsel to people, whether they're people we work with or whether they're our family members or people in our church, sometimes part of what we need to do in admonishing is to warn them. And there's a responsibility that goes along with that, recognizing that it's a serious thing that we have to present and to challenge people with the truth of God's word and the warnings that go along with it as well. Popular? No. Usually warnings are things, I mean, parents, do kids enjoy your warnings? Yeah, it's usually not met with real enthusiasm. But it's important nonetheless. And often warnings have to be said more than once in more than one way. And that's what we have in the prophets. We have them saying warnings different ways using different illustrations and those kinds of things. Question? I thought you were waving that hand back there. Questions, thoughts before Pastor Dan comes back up and finishes us up this evening?
Daniel, some of our favorite stories to tell grandkids or kids out of the book of Daniel. Some great miracles occur in the book of Daniel. You see halfway down, just reviewing that, halfway down is on John's sheet, Daniel's era is one of six in the Bible with a major focus on miracles by which God accomplished his purposes. We see the creation, patriarchs, Elijah and Elisha, Jesus and the apostles in the time of the second advent. But Daniel, just quickly look at Daniel 4, 34 and 35. Through all of these major prophets that we've been going through, Israel has not listened, has not recognized God. Jeremiah, the failure, he was not able to get anyone to follow him. And so in Daniel's time there in exile for the 70 years under four or five different rulers, he watches and sees this miracle occur to Nebuchadnezzar. He is turned into a cow, basically, for 7 years. He eats grass. His fingernails grow. His hair has the dew of the morning on him. He's a beast. And 4:34, at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. In my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forevermore. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? Here's a foreign king, as far as possible removed from God's people. He was the one that ordered the destruction. And yet he comes to recognize who God is. Daniel records it for us. The Jews couldn't understand, but Nebuchadnezzar understood. One of the theme is God's sovereign plan for Israel. Another one that I saw was maintaining hope in exile. And if you think about Daniel, in the first wave that went into exile, as probably a teenager, trained in all the intricacies of the royal court so that he would not offend anyone. And he was found to be among the wisest. He had a great career amongst the different rulers that were there. I handed out a sheet today. Most of you got it. The walk through the prophetical books. Again, part of walk through the Bible. You note there's seven prophets that were reaching out to Judah. Just two that were reaching out to Israel. Jonah and Nahum were tasked with reaching cities of Assyria. Obadiah was in Edom. And Ezekiel and Daniel are the Jews in exile. And then as they come back, we have Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi when they come back to Jerusalem. On the back, just another, some of the colorful terms you see, and that's where I got for Isaiah, groan in the first half and glory in the second. But Jeremiah there was a rotten girdle. He had to hack that out. Lamentation, tears, lament. Ezekiel, the valley of dry bones. Daniel, we have down dreams. Dreams played a prominent role in the book of Daniel. And it's the notes from here to eternity, chapters 10 through 12, speak of dreams and prophecy in future times. So just good reminders. You talked about the watchtower, the watchman. Habakkuk actually talks about a watchtower. And so you'll see different terms that come up. Again, just another reference that you can remember some of the books by. Daniel, dreams. He was gifted by God, as was Joseph, with the interpretation of dreams. He was very useful and trustworthy. He was put in a position of power and maintained that position of power through the 70 years. So again, I said one of the themes would be maintaining hope in exile. As a theme, God's sovereign plan for Israel. And get this, God is using evil kings to carry out his message, to carry out his punishment, as it were, too. We have the four different kingdoms there that are noted. Babylon, the third paragraph down, 605 to 539. Medo-Persia, 539 to 331. Greece, 331 to 146. And Rome, 146 to AD 476, all the way to the advent of Christ. Israel is in the background. Israel is waiting. These kingdoms have led the civilized world there for some 1,100 years. You note in that same paragraph, key aspect within the overarching theme of God's kingly control is Messiah's coming to rule the world in glory. Even with all the facts of the nation being in exile, he shows through all of the book of Daniel his continued plan right up to the end of time. The first six chapters you see history, again, the lion's den, the statue, statue that they're to bow down to, the fiery furnace. And even in chapter 1, Daniel's start in the time there in Babylon, him saying, verse 8 of chapter 1, he purposed in his heart that he would follow God. So where Rick had to deal with some of the prophets that, where's the hope? Where's the hope? I am encouraged with the book of Daniel that Daniel purposed in his heart that he was going to serve God. He was steadfast in prayer in the sixth chapter. He got in trouble because he continued steadfast in his prayer. And the testimony of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I got to pronounce that the right way, even if you throw us in the fiery furnace, he may save us, he may not, but he is able to deliver us if he desires to. What testimonies these men had in their years of exile. And I'll close my time with the key verses, Daniel 2:20. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever." Remember who he's saying this to. "For wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him." Daniel, maintaining hope in exile. If you would, take your hymnals.
576.
Five, 576 out of Lamentation.